I'd be sitting at my computer typing and, or not on my computer because we didn't have computers back then, sitting at my typewriter typing a story and never knew when someone was going to plant a kiss on my neck or massage my shoulders or make a comment about my body. And it was just, and I would be instantly turned into a 5-year-old because I had PTSD really bad, but didn't realize it. I didn't recognize it. People didn't talk about those things back then from the sexual trauma that I had experienced as a child.
Welcome to Your Story Doesn't End Here, the mental health podcast of military and veterans who refuse to be silenced. I'm your host, Rachel, and my mission with this podcast is to be a voice for those who don't have a voice, bring awareness to mental health issues, provide value and solutions, and to change the culture when it comes to mental health within the DoD organizations. Hey, everyone, and thank you so much for coming back for another episode of Your Story Doesn't End Here. Today's guest is CJ Scarlett, aka the Badass Grandma, who is a danger expert and the author of books that help parents empower their kids to protect and defend themselves from dangerous people. CJ knows firsthand how violence can destroy lives. A survivor of childhood abuse and teen sexual assault, CJ spent years dealing with the emotional aftermath of her experience. After taking her power back, she became an advocate for others who had been victimized, running a child advocacy center and serving as director of victims issues for the North Carolina Attorney General's office. Over her 30 years as a victim advocate, CJ has helped thousands of survivors claim their power too. The former roller skating car hop, forest firefighter, and U.S. Marine photojournalist holds a master's degree in human violence. Named one of the happy 100 people on the planet, CJ's story of triumph over adversity is featured in several best-selling books. CJ, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Rachel, thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Yeah, so, you know, there's so many interesting parts of your story and everything that you have accomplished in your lifetime. So I'm so excited to hear what you have to say, and I'm going to pass it off to you to share more of your story with the listeners.
Sure. Thank you very much. Well, my dad was a career Marine. So I was born at Camp Pendleton, California, at the Marine base there. And my oldest son was actually born there 20 something years later. My father was in logistics. And so we were stationed between Camp Pendleton and Barstow, California, in the Mojave Desert. And when he would deploy overseas to Okinawa, we would move our family to Connecticut, where my folks' family was located. And so I went back and forth between California and Connecticut as a child. And then when I was 12 years old, my dad retired from the Marine Corps at 20 years and moved us to a little tiny goat town in Mena, Arkansas. And the population was 5,000 for the whole county. Let's see, 50 years later, the population is still 5,000 in the entire county. So it's a really small town with really small town values. And it was very different from where I had been raised in very liberal California and Connecticut. So, for example, I was very active on the track team even at 12 years old, and I had a lot of potential there. But when I got to MENA, girls couldn't even run on the boys' track field. There were no sports for girls. They had gymnastics for a couple years when I was a little older that I participated in, but there were no other sports for girls. And in fact, it was so backward, they tore the pages on reproduction out of the biology books and wondered why they had one of the highest teen pregnancy rates in the nation.
Oh my gosh.
So I was not happy there in Mena, Arkansas. The whole time I lived there for 8 years, I was not happy. Now, when I was 15, is when I became the roller skating car hop. That was my first W-2 job where I actually got paid besides babysitting and keep cleaning houses and so forth. And then at 18, after I graduated from high school, I went to work for the Young Adult Conservation Corps, which is where I became a firefighter for the Forest Service. And enjoyed that a lot, but the camp was closing down. The camp we were located in was closing down. So I was kind of adrift. And my father said, talk to the Marine Corps recruiter. And I wasn't going to, my dad had been a Marine. My twin brother was a Marine. Two brothers-in-law were Marines. Eventually, my little brother was a Marine. So there was no way I was going to talk to the Army, Navy, or Air Force, or Coast Guard. It had to be the Marine Corps. And I went and talked to the recruiter. I aced the ASVAB. I got a 6-year contract for photojournalism with guarantee that if I was honor graduate of my platoon, that I would graduate in E3 and within 8 months would be promoted to corporal. So that was in my contract, which just becomes important later on. So I joined the delayed entry program about 2 months, maybe a month and a half before I went to boot camp. And I just flourished in the delayed entry program. My recruiter gave me lots and lots of attention. My dad and my recruiter taught me my general orders, how to field strip an M16, how to march, all the stuff that people stumble over and really struggle to learn in those beginning days of boot camp. I knew all that stuff before I ever went. And my dad had raised me on stories about how he was beaten, severely beaten, in boot camp at Parris Island in the 1950s. And so by the time I got to boot camp, I fully expected to be beaten every day. And I'll tell you more about that in just a second. But anyway, my recruiter was a father of four, married man, and gave me more attention than I really wanted. He was in a position of authority over me, and he ended up sexually assaulting me. And what's really sad is that all the male recruiters were having sex with all the female recruits. It was commonly done. This is in 1981, and it was a common practice. And there was, gosh, I don't know what to say, except that it was rampant. The sexual assaults and the affairs and everything was just rampant. So this married man with four kids took advantage of a 20-year-old girl. And I had been molested as a child and was also raped at the age of 19 by a sheriff's deputy I was dating. So when I joined the Marine Corps, I thought, Rachel, that I was escaping that past. I was escaping that little town in Arkansas, and I was escaping the sexual assaults that had given me PTSD, and that I was having a fresh start. But then my recruiter raped me. And I feel like, gosh, you know, there's something wrong with me that makes other people do bad things. It wasn't their fault. It was my fault somehow. I had a tremendous amount of shame. But anyway, I go off to boot camp at Parris Island on my 20th birthday. And again, I knew everything before I left, all the hard stuff. And so when I got there and all they could do was yell at us, they couldn't hit us like they hit my dad. They would just yell at us. And I'm like, the girls would be crying themselves to sleep at night in the bunks beside me going, I want to go home. And I lay there and think, this is it? All they're going to do is yell at me? I can do this. So I excelled in boot camp and I ended up being the honor graduate, which meant that I graduated as a Lance Corporal in E3. And 8 months later, I was promoted to corporal. So I rose through the ranks very quickly because then a year and a half after that, I was promoted to sergeant to E5. So I had a lot of, I was promoted very quickly, but I didn't have the leadership skills and experience to back that up. I never went to NCO school. For some reason, I always missed NCO school, which you have to go through when you're in E4 and E5. So a lot was expected of me that I didn't know because I just didn't have the experience. But I was a photojournalist, which is the coolest job you can have in the military. I would fly in a helicopter one day and stand on the skids and shoot machine guns and ride in tanks and shoot, you know, light armor weapons and interview movie stars and generals and infantrymen. And oh my gosh, ran the base newspaper at Camp Pendleton and then again in Albany, Georgia, where we were stationed. It was just the best job in the world. I will tell you about my first day on the job, though, when I actually stopped a war. I had come fresh from boot camp, and I arrived at the public affairs office at Camp Pendleton, and there was nobody there except one staff sergeant, because everybody else was on the beach, Del Mar Beach in Camp Pendleton, 54 miles of beautiful beach, for a Navy-Marine Corps exercise. And so I was just kind of twiddling my thumbs, but then one of the local TV stations called, and they wanted to go cover the exercise. So they had me escort the media crew. So the photographer, the videographer, and the reporter and I drive out to the base, to the beach, and we get there, and everything's going great. They're shooting, the machine guns are shooting, the riflemen are firing, the tanks are rolling, the helicopters are flying, the ships are sailing, everything's going great. And then the videographer decides he wants to get a shot of the machine gunners. And he starts to walk in front of them. And Rachel, I'm like, are you out of your mind? And I threw my body bravely in front of him and said, cease fire, cease fire. And all down the line you hear, cease fire, cease fire, cease fire. And the ships stop sailing and the helicopters land and the tanks stop rolling and the guns stop firing. And I'm like, there, get your shot. I'm thinking, what a dumbass. I didn't know they were firing blanks. The general of the base comes over the hill going, who the bleep stopped my exercise? And everyone pointed at me. And that's when I got my nickname, Corporal Gullible. And it's actually the first time the man who had become my husband met me, because he was in a foxhole nearby and saw the whole thing go down. And he worked in my office with me, and he thought, boy, this girl doesn't know anything. So anyway, that was our auspicious
Wouldn't
start.
it just be like standard practice to not walk in front of a machine gun, blanks or
I
not?
would think so. I would think so. I mean, anyway,
Did you get in trouble for that?
no, I didn't get in
Oh,
trouble, but I
that's
was a
good.
laughing stock for a good long time.
Fair
I
enough,
got
fair
in
enough.
trouble in other ways. So, I really love my time at Camp Pendleton. Again, it was where I was born. It's a beautiful, beautiful base. I had the best job in the whole wide world. The problem was the sexual harassment was rampant. It was like MASH. I can't watch this. I used to think MASH was funny, but I don't think it's funny anymore because the women are constantly being groped and having comments made about them. And I'd be sitting at my computer typing and or not on my computer because we didn't have computers back then, sitting at my typewriter typing a story and never knew when someone was going to plant a kiss on my neck or massage my shoulders or make a comment about my body. And it was just, and I would be instantly turned into a 5-year-old because I had PTSD really bad, but didn't realize it. I didn't recognize it. People didn't talk about those things back then from the sexual trauma that I had experienced as a child. So I spent the first 4 years of my Marine Corps career at Camp Pendleton, got married to, again, the gentleman I worked with, had my first son at 22, and then we got stationed in Albany, Georgia, which is a little tiny town near Alabama. Alabama, I think it is. Yeah. And the boss there was not, did not sexually harass me, but he didn't like women in his Marine Corps. And since my husband and I were two sergeants working in the same office, but he had seniority over me, so he was my boss. My husband was my boss. And our commander would pit him against me. I would do something he didn't like, and he would make my husband make me stand at attention in front of everybody and chew me out. I mean, it was an untenable work environment. Oh my gosh. He was just such a troublemaker trying to pit me and my husband against each other. So I was getting very, very depressed because I went in with in the Marine Corps with a roar, with a bang. I mean, honor graduate my platoon, kicking butt. And I felt like I went out with a whimper because I ended up having to get into counseling. And after that, my boss would introduce me to people and refer to me as this crazy Marine, which was even more demoralizing and demeaning. And I was discharged from the Marine Corps with bipolar disorder. My twin brother had been discharged for the same thing, and so they diagnosed me with bipolar disorder and kicked me out. They wouldn't let me stay in, which was good because I really didn't need to be in at that point. I was not in great emotional shape. And so I got out in 86, and then my husband and I got stationed at Syracuse, where he was attending the university for a photojournalism program, and then we went to Norfolk, Virginia. We ended up getting divorced while we were there, and I had my second son. So everything was, I was still a mess. I was still a mess from my experience in the Marine Corps. I felt like I had failed the Marine Corps. I felt like I had failed myself. I felt like I had failed my family and had this underlying post-traumatic stress that was just coloring every area of my life. And one day I was working at United Way and I was sitting in a room filled with the community leaders talking about the next United Way campaign. And all of a sudden I burst into tears. And I fled to the bathroom, and for 2 hours I sobbed in a stall. I couldn't tell my coworkers what was wrong because I didn't know. And after that, I went away to Connecticut for a week. I just got my car and with a journal and left my husband with my two kids and went to Connecticut to figure out what was going on with me. And that's when all the memories and the stuff about the recruiter and the childhood stuff and the sexual assault by the sheriff's deputy, it was just blurted onto the pages. And I got into counseling immediately at the Rape Crisis Center. At the same time, within a week of that, I was diagnosed with lupus and scleroderma, which are autoimmune conditions that affect the joints and the lungs and the heart and all your major organs. And so I was disabled off and on over the next couple of years, over the next, well, still today, I was disabled off and on. But I was determined to go back to college to finish my bachelor's degree. And I started college. Back to college at Virginia Wesleyan University in Norfolk, Virginia. And then got the VA gave me the opportunity to go to graduate school. And I sure wasn't going to turn that down. So I got a master's degree in human violence. And while I was in graduate school, I got a job as a director of the Child Advocacy Center in Elizabeth City, North Carolina. And that's how I ended up here in North Carolina. Then I followed my heart to Raleigh and I got married for the second time. I divorced my first husband somewhere in there. I'm not a bigamist. So followed my heart to Raleigh and became the Director of Victims Issues at the North Carolina Attorney General's Office. And I worked for the last 33 years, ever since I got started working on myself. I started advocating for other people who had been victimized because I was just so angry at the time that these people were being hurt and I wanted to do something about it. But I worked for years as an advocate, but it becomes very overwhelming to constantly be dealing with crime after it happens. So around 1998, I decided that I was going to do something to keep from happening at all. And I started working on technologies that were going to help keep people safe. But in 2000, I became very disabled because of the lupus. It hit me again very, very hard. And I became so debilitated that I had to go up and down the stairs on my hands and knees. I couldn't have lifted a cup. I couldn't turn a doorknob. My weight ballooned to 240 pounds from the steroids that I was on. And I was in constant pain. And in 2002, the doctors told me that my heart was failing, that I could die at any time. And Rachel, I was terrified. I was absolutely petrified. And then I got the chance to meet privately with a Tibetan Buddhist Lama for advice. And I hobbled up to the Lama's house and I made a pitiful bow and I poured out my tale of woe and I waited for him to shower me with much deserved sympathy. And that's when I learned that Lamas don't do dramas, because he gave me a cosmic bitch slap. He told me to stop feeling sorry for myself and start thinking about other people. And I was offended and defensive because I couldn't take care of myself. How could I help anybody else? But he insisted. So on the way home, I was driving and an ambulance flew by with the siren blaring and I said a quick wish for the person inside that they would find help and healing. And I thought, well, that's easy. I can do that. So I started leaving the better handicapped space for someone else and let the mom with the crying baby go ahead of me in line at the grocery store and little tiny things like that. And I felt a little happier. So I decided to make it a practice to do at least one act of kindness every single day. So I put inspirational notes on the driver's side door at the cancer center and in books at the used bookstore. I gave a woman my cane she was struggling to walk and I gave her my cane. I one time I tried to hand out flowers at the grocery store, but everyone thought I was a Hare Krishna. Nobody would take the flowers. it was very funny. I volunteered at the Red Cross after Hurricane Katrina and I felt happier. And what had happened is that I become so consumed by my own suffering that I forgot that everyone's fighting a hard battle. Everyone has a story to tell. Everyone has had trauma in their life in some form or fashion. And doing these acts of kindness reconnected me to humanity and it healed my heart. And I reached a point where I was so happy that it didn't matter whether I was sick or well or even living or dying. I was just content. And at that point, my condition went into remission. And today I've lived 20 years past when they told me I was going to die. And I feel better today than I did in 1990 when I was first diagnosed with lupus and scleroderma. I mean, it's amazing what generosity and gratitude can do to transform a life. Just amazing. So I tell you this story about my military experience and about the trauma that I endured in the military that kind of coincided with the trauma I had from my childhood and my teen years, to say that there's light at the end of the trauma tunnel. I mean, I was so messed up and I hated myself for most of my life because I blamed myself for the things that had happened to me and because I felt like I had failed my country. I mean, that's a pretty big burden to put on yourself. But I eventually, through therapy, realized that it wasn't my fault that those people did the things that they did, that there was nothing wrong with me. I did not need to be filled with shame. I recognized that I'm a divine being just as I was when I was born. It's just crap that was kind of put on me and that I put on myself. And once I dealt with it and processed it all, I was free. And when I claimed my power, it was the most liberating thing I've ever done in my life. So my body has not gotten the message. I still have severe PTSD physically, in that I have a freeze response. It's off the charts. I mean, if someone even speaks to me harshly, I am paralyzed. And so we're still dealing with that. But in terms of the therapy, I'm doing fantastic. In 2008, I wrote my first book, and it's an inspirational book called Neptune's Gift. And then in 2017, I wrote The Badass Girl's Guide, Uncommon Strategies to Outwit Predators, to help for women and girls about how to protect themselves, how to keep from being sexually assaulted in the first place, but how to fight their way out of a bad situation. And then I had grandkids in 2015, and I started having nightmares about, well, I have a degree in human violence. I can imagine every awful thing there is. So in 2020, I published Badass Parenting and Heroic Parenting, which are the same book for parents of kids 0 to 9, except Heroic Parenting is PG rated and Badass Parenting is not PG rated. Very snarky, very inappropriate sometimes, but very fun. My new book for parents of tweens and teens is coming out November 15th, and it's called Raising Badass Kids. And it's my answer to how do we keep it from happening at all? Well, how we keep it from happening at all is that we educate our children about how to protect and defend themselves. And I'm doing it through the parents. I'm giving the parents the power, giving them the advice, the tips, the tools, the information they need to teach their children easy ways how to say no to an adult or another kid that's making you uncomfortable, how to trust your intuition, how to have boundaries, how to physically defend yourself like a rabid Tasmanian devil if you have to by using just your bodily weapons. And I've just been hired by Bark. Bark.us is the world's leading parental monitoring app company, and they've hired me to do some short form video content for them, which is great. So that's getting the message out far and wide to millions of parents everywhere. So I feel like I've really arrived now. I've gone from being a victim, a true victim, heart, mind, and soul, to being victorious and being in a position where I have the experience and the expertise and the authority to be able to help kids from being harmed. And I will spend the rest of my life doing this. I don't care if I'm 85 years old and doddering with cane, I'm going to be doing this work.
That's incredible. Can you give us just an idea? Like, I know you talked through timelines a little bit, but how many years did it truly take for you to go from this traumatic state to a place where you could get a degree in human violence and be okay with that without it, like physically, without it paralyzing you as a person with all your PTSD and trauma? How long did that take to get to that point of your healing journey? Because I know healing isn't linear.
No, it's not linear. My number one coping mechanism is dissociation. I still grapple with it, although it's gotten a lot better. But back then, I would dissociate all the time over everything. And so when I started my healing process in 1990, let's see, I went to started graduate school in 1992. So I started working on my human violence degree in 92, 93 rather, from 93 to 95. It didn't impact me as much. I didn't get triggered because I was so dissociated from my own experience with violence and what I was learning. And it was also on a more general level of how can people do the terrible things they do to other people. So I studied interpersonal violence, child abuse, domestic violence, to institutional violence, war, terrorism, all those things. And it was very academic. So it was easier to deal with than if it had been. It wasn't anything like dealing with therapy. Therapy was hard, but the education was not.
It's interesting that you bring up the dissociation because that's been a coping mechanism that I've used too. And I think when people look from the outside in to someone who dissociates as a coping mechanism, oftentimes they can misinterpret that and feel like maybe it's not as bad. And then I know for me, and maybe this is just me speaking from my personal experiences, me judging myself, thinking, oh, maybe it's not that bad because I disassociated with a specific experience and even buried certain experiences to where I don't remember them unless something like, and when I've started writing, I'm trying to write a book myself. It's been in the works for years, but there sometimes when I'm writing, things will come up like that too. I'll remember a specific instance that I'd forgotten about, or I'll come across someone on social media that happened to be around during a specific event. And so it's interesting that you bring that up. Because I think a lot of people use that coping mechanism. And sometimes for me personally, it can make me get in my head and feel like, oh, maybe it's not that bad. There's a lot of
That's
other
called
things. Go ahead.
Well, that's called toxic positivity, and I agree with you completely. Other people see us functioning perfectly, or at least well, so we're not a raving mess, and so they assume everything's hunky-dory, and we convince ourselves of the same thing because we feel we can put on a happy face, and we can function, and we can excel at work, and so we think, well, I'm not doing that bad, and inside, it's like fruit that looks good on the outside, but it's rotten on the inside. It's falling apart on the inside.
There's a few other things that you talked about too that I think are super relatable. The getting kicked out of the military even if it is for the right reasons, medical, for example. I think a lot of people can relate to that. I've had a few guests on the show that have had early discharges for medical reasons. And a lot of people really struggle with that feeling of did I do enough? Did I fail because I left the military early? So that's definitely relatable. And then you also talked about just being a female in the military in general. I think that the military has come a really long way when it comes to sexual assault and how things are handled. And you and I chit-chatted a little bit about this prior to the episode. And then I'd love for you to repeat what you told me before we started recording, because I think it's an important topic to talk about. But, you know, there's some of these things that are still happening. I had a friend when I was serving that she too was very uncomfortable with like the shoulder touches. And not everyone thinks that a shoulder touch is triggering. But I will tell you that, like, if you're working with someone, you should not be touching them anyway. I had a coworker that would touch like the back of the arm around the, like, to me, it was super cringy. And he was always like, oh, well, this is like a safe space to touch on someone. But in my head, I'm like, well, why are we touching anyone at all? Because you just never know. And some people's response to touch is they will get violent, you know, they'll hit back, or, you know, it's just like a reflex to them. And so, yes, we've come a really long way. Yes, you know, you're not seeing as many rapes with recruiters and whatever, you know, positional authoritative figures, but you still see them, and they're not reported to the numbers that they actually are. So the statistics, you might as well throw the statistics out the window, because I would say 99.9% of females that I've talked to that I've served have been sexually assaulted or sexually harassed in some way in their service. And when I tell that to parents, which is why I think it's so important that the work that you're doing, that's going to help set up females for a better experience, not only in life, but, or not even just females, males and females, a better experience in life to feel more empowered to stand up for themselves. But I always say that had I been a little more prepared for what to expect in the military and not going in thinking it was going to be this big family, I would finally be safe. That, you know, people don't hurt each other in the military because it's one giant family. That's the expectation that I had. I think it creates a level of vulnerability. But I do talk to a lot of parents. So when they ask me about their daughters joining the military, and I tell them how it can be, and just, you know, make sure they know how it can be. Not that everyone's experience is bad, but it can happen. And it's important to know it can happen. How do we protect ourselves from it? And I think it terrifies a lot of parents. So, but yeah,
I'd like to be honest with them, because I get asked by parents and I get asked by young women, you know, I'm thinking of joining the military. What do you think? And I'm honest with them. I mean, I used to say, oh, it's a great learning, you know, you'll learn discipline. And now I tell them, you know, the statistics are, and again, they're underreported. So the statistics are currently, though, that 1 in 4 women in general will be sexually assaulted in their lifetime. In the military, it's 1 in 3.
Yeah.
It's more than 35% of women and, you know, men will be sexually assaulted in the military.
Yeah.
So I tell them, it's a great experience for you if you are prepared and have strong boundaries. And know that you are likely to be subjected to sexual harassment and potential assault. But if you feel confident in your ability to put up boundaries to protect yourself, then go for it. But if you were like me, I'm a freezer and a fawner, no way.
I like that.
If I could go back and give myself advice, I'd be like, I'm so grateful for my military experience because I serve my country. I'm very proud of that. And I get all my VA benefits, which is awesome, you know. But I suffered a lot in the military, a lot. And I don't know if I would not want my granddaughters to go in.
Yeah.
I wouldn't. Yeah. I hate to say that. I mean, I know this is a show about patriots, but yeah. I would not want them to go in.
But it's true. You know, there is a certain type. And I think that I grew a lot in my military experience. I really stepped into the person that I am today that stands up for other people. And stands up for myself in situations where I would not have before the military. But I love the way that you portray, like, hey, know that you can have a really great experience, but know that it is still not only a male dominated industry, because there's also females that are very toxic leaders in the military as well, even to this day. I think that's bred from years and years of feeling like they had to fit a certain mold or hit a certain standard. And I've heard this from previous guests too, being told you either have to be the bitch or a slut, or, you know, a certain
there was
mold.
Nothing in between.
Exactly.
There was nothing in between.
Yeah. 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 Or you just don't make it, you know, that's what people are telling women. That's what other women are mentoring other women to in the military. And it's really, really sad because it shouldn't have to be that way. But you talked about something about, the sexual assaults and how they're reported. And I would love to cover that topic.
Do you remember are what you it was? Referring to the,
the names, the database?
Yes. When I went to the VA, when I didn't go to the Veterans Administration for disability for years and years and years because I felt like I didn't deserve it. I hadn't been to combat. I hadn't lost a leg. I hadn't experienced combat trauma. And so I felt like my experience didn't matter. It didn't count. But I've gotten to therapy through the VA and they talked to me and convinced me. I mean, it helped me realize that I was fighting a war of my own. You know, I was emotionally and physically damaged because of what happened to me. It affected my marriage. It ended my first marriage. I mean, it had a tremendous impact on me. So anyway, I finally went to the VA to apply for disability benefits for the sexual assaults. And I had an hour to pour out all the stuff that happened to a therapist that I didn't know, I'd never met. And it was grueling. It was wrenching. It was gut wrenching. I mean, it was awful experience. And I came out of there and I thought, you know what? She never asked me who did it. And I thought, I wonder if they ever ask who did it, because they should be keeping a database of the perpetrators. You don't have to, you know, it's not like you're going to take one report and go out and arrest somebody. But if you get a dozen reports about the same person perpetrating these crimes from different sources, from different women or men, the military needs to know that. They need to do something about that. Yeah. And so they should be keeping a record. I worked for a company called Evidence Vault for a short period that was creating this virtual vault where you could go in if you were assaulted, you could go in and you could put in any evidence you had. You could tell your story, you could put photos of your injuries, you could put DNA, you could do any whatever you wanted, and it would hold this in this virtual vault. And then if someone else entered, named the same perpetrator, it would link the accounts and notify the law enforcement so that they could take action. Callisto is a company that works with college campuses on sexual assault, and they've introduced something similar to that on college campuses only, but I believe it'll be common practice soon for all communities across the country.
I love that.
And I think it's about time because they could catch so many more, stop so much abuse by linking up these cases.
Right, right.
And if I'd known that I could have saved other women from being assaulted by my recruiter, I would have spoken up sooner, but it didn't occur to me.
Right, right.
You know?
Well, I think what I love the most about the database option is that it protects people who report. And to expound on this a little bit more, I think people like myself decided not to report sexual assault in the military because I didn't want to put myself through that grueling process of an unrestricted report. I've heard horror stories about unrestricted reports about, you know, and everyone knows about it because it's now information that's out there. A lot of
and
times.
And you're labeled, you're marked after that.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. I saw friends of mine were labeled as the snitch for telling on someone. You know, I just didn't see very positive experiences come out of it. And then when I told just a bit of the story of what happened to me to my command, I wasn't met with, oh my gosh, are you okay? Let's make sure you get the help you need. I was met with, oh, well, why did you do this? Why did you sit on his bed? Why did you show up to his place? Like, you know, it's not, and the unrestricted report process is not the type of process that I think really helps people. And I'm sure it has helped people. I'm not saying it hasn't, but I don't think overarching, I don't think it's helping like it is intended to. Now, when you give people the option to still feel like they are protecting other people, they're still reporting, they're still getting their story out there, and they're getting the help they need via a database where now there's a little bit more privacy, but now there's something out there in case this person is a predator and maybe you're the second person that reported. I think it gives people more, what's the word? Freedom's not the right word, but it gives people more options, and it helps in a way that still protects the identity. Cause there's so many survivors of sexual assault walking around in our military today, in the veteran population. And I remember when Vanessa Guillen, when her life was taken from her, I don't know if you were a part of this, but there was a group on Facebook that was created, and it was mostly, I think it was all women. I think it was all women, but it was crazy the amount of people that felt empowered to share their story for the first time when Vanessa Guillen, when her story came out. The sad thing, CJ, is that as fast as these people told their stories for the first time, people were taking that and they were mandatory. They felt they had to mandatory report it to commands. So people were taking the power away from these survivors and they were reporting. So people took their stories down and they silenced themselves once again. And it was really, really sad to see that, because it's hard enough to carry around the weight of a story and to finally be like, oh my gosh, I'm in a safe space. I can share my story. And then for someone else to be like, and I think that's a flaw with the unrestricted report, is people take the survivor's power away again.
What's great about Evidence Vault and what Callisto is doing is that you can decide if the cases are linked and they say, oh my gosh, this guy has raped three women, or three women has allegedly raped three women. The police can go to the women and say, we're building a case here. Are you willing to testify? But the woman always has a choice. Or the person, man or woman, always has a choice about whether they choose to testify. You are doing such impactful work, and you're talking with the legislators. Maybe you can talk about Callisto and what they're doing and get them to do something similar with the military.
That'd be phenomenal. I thought I heard something about it. It may not have been in sexual. I thought I heard something similar about something like this when I was serving. I'm going to have to double check and see if that has been implemented in the military yet, or if it's something they're talking about. It sounded kind of familiar when you started talking about it, but again, a lot of these resources, and this isn't even just in the world of sexual assault, there's thousands of resources that exist for military veterans, people in general, but if we don't know about them, then it just becomes another resource.
And it's really not the military's interest to make that stuff public, because they don't want to have to report that, oh my God, you know, we were saying 35%, it's only 44%, you know?
Right.
They don't want to have to gather statistics, to cover their own butts.
Yeah.
They will resist change and accountability.
Right.
Because it will put them on the spot and have to actually do something. So it will be an uphill climb, but I think things are getting better slowly.
Yeah.
I think that the sexual assaults are still way too high in the military. There shouldn't be any, of course, but I think there's probably less sexual harassment. There's still sexual harassment, and it's still pretty bad.
But it's not what it was in the 80s.
But the recruiters aren't having just cherry picking recruits like they used to.
Yeah.
You know, so in some ways, it's gotten better.
Right. And I think a lot of that attributes to the world in general. The culture of the world has changed, especially in the U.S. So when we look at people being more empowered, my daughter at 1 year old is more confident than I was at 1 year old. I'm sure. I don't remember what I was like at 1 year old, but the 90s when I was growing up was a different time. You know, the world has changed so much in the last so many years. Women feel more empowered to stand up for themselves in general. Mm-hmm. Men feel more empowered to stand up for themselves in general. We still see these things happening. But the military is such a weird climate, because it's one of those places where from the get-go, you're taught you're a lower rank. So you stay in your lane and you don't
question authority. Loyalty is everything. Loyalty is everything. Suck it up, buttercup, because... that's the way it goes.
Yep. And then you and I were talking about, you know, someone that I had come across recently that used the rank of, you know, E8, saying, you know, I can do what I want because I hold this position. And that's another issue that still exists in the military, is the I'm a leader because I hold a rank. And if there's anything that I learned about leadership when I separated from the military, and I'm sure you can agree to this too, is that the rank does not mean you're a leader. Not at all. So... Nope.
I met some of the best and worst people of my life in the military.
A lot of great people.
So I have some really good memories of my military experience. I'm proud to be a veteran. But like, we have a Women's Marines Association here, and the women are just so gung-ho about the Marine Corps and their experience. I think that's awesome. I just don't feel that way. I didn't have the same experience.
Right. Yeah. That's the veteran community is so interesting because you really do get every piece of the spectrum. You get the people that absolutely love, especially Marines. Marines are a whole different breed because I mean there's so much pride in the Marine Corps that the Navy just doesn't have it. You know, when I was in A school, I was in Pensacola. There was the Navy side, there was the Marines, and you can just tell there's a lot more pride and respect. Even from the lower ranks. I mean, I remember E3 Marines were treated like you're higher ranked than me. I'm an E1, I'll respect you. In the Navy, if you're an E3, you might as well be an E1.
Yeah, that's the biggest thing I tell people. Of all the services, the Marine Corps respects its troops more than any other service because, in the Army, in the Army, in my opinion, treats them the worst. I mean, I've been under Army command before for journalism, foot of journalism school, and they treated their people horribly. But the Marine Corps, once you get past private, you're doing all right. Then it's sort of like, okay, well, I guess you're going to hang around, so we're going to treat you with more respect. So.
I wish they were all like that. And I know the military is changing constantly, but yeah, it's such a different dynamic across the branches. When you were a
Oh, it is.
photojournalist, what's some cool stuff that you got to see? I know you kind of braised over it earlier.
Gosh, I did get to interview a bunch of movie stars, which was really cool because they would come to the base to film movies and we have to escort them. So, and I would name names as if you wouldn't probably know who any of them are because I don't think you were born when I was in the military.
No, I was born in
Well, you,
92.
oh my God, I was in the military in 81 to 86 and you weren't even born yet. Oh my gosh, I feel so old. But, yeah, being the editor of the base newspaper was really fun because that was in the day when we didn't have computers. And so cut and paste literally meant you ran it through the sheet of copy through a machine, through a glue machine, a wax machine, excuse me. And then you literally use an X-Acto to cut out words and paste them onto the page and photos and everything. And we had a dark room for our photography, and it was just so much fun.
Have fun.
So,
You know,
so much fun.
I sometimes there's times that I miss the old way that like things like photography used to be. I really liked typewriters when I was younger. I really liked the dark rooms and the film photography. And there's a certain level of effort that goes into it that makes it so much more satisfying, right? Than, you know, now we live in this world of instant gratification. So it's such a different world. But photojournalism, that sounds like it would have been a really, really cool career.
And something I've used the rest of my life. I mean, it's marketing, public relations, communications, community
Absolutely.
relations. I've used every single ounce of it since I
That's
got out of the
awesome.
military.
That's awesome. So as far as what you're doing now, what's next for you?
I am working on online courses of my books so that parents can pick and choose the videos they want to watch according to what their needs are. So if their child's being bullied, they can go to an 8-minute video on how to teach your child to train a bully to leave them alone. If their child's been sexually abused, what does criminal justice process look like? What does cyber bullying look like? What is sexting? What is sextortion? And all these different topics, because we are actually physically living in the safest time we've lived in the history of the planet, of human beings. It's safer now than when I was a kid in the 60s, where crime is really going up in a seriously bad way is online. And we've got creepers out there, and we've got trolls, and we've got people who would say and do things online that they would never do face to face. It's like the online opens a Pandora's box where the worst of us comes out. And so kids are horrible anyway to each other in school. And then you put them on the internet and they start with the relational bullying and it becomes, I mean, kids are committing suicide over it. It's really tragic.
Are your books, are they in libraries, or are they in
They're
schools,
in
or
Amazon. They're on Amazon.
okay.
Because I take a snarky, rather inappropriate perspective. They're not in schools right now, but they're in some libraries and definitely available on Amazon. So I've got Badass Parenting, Heroic Parenting, and Raising Badass Kids that'll be coming out November 15th.
That's awesome. Yeah,
I'm so excited.
I feel like, and I guess this is just coming from someone that grew up not feeling empowered to stand up for myself. I feel like something like this is very valuable to kids. I understand where other parents would be like, oh, I don't want that in schools. And I know that's a whole other debate with books and libraries and schools and stuff with what's going on in the world right now. But I don't know. I think that would be a really cool.
I will send you a copy of my book. You
I
choose
would
between
love it.
heroic parenting and badass
Yeah,
parenting. You
I'll take
choose.
the
Okay.
badass
I'm not
one.
surprised. I didn't want to assume, but I'm not surprised.
No, that's really cool what you're doing, and I
Thank you.
applaud you for taking that on, because I think that parenting is such a interesting experience in general, and I'm such a huge believer of, no one really teaches us how to be a human being. We're all just doing the best we can with the information we have, and sometimes that information that we have isn't great information, and it's not our fault. It's just how we were raised, but we don't know what we don't know. And so to be able to educate ourselves as parents, as even relatives, aunts, uncles, to be able to raise the next generation to feel more empowered, to take care of themselves, to lift up the next person, because if my daughter knows that she's empowered, maybe a friend or someone that she comes across doesn't feel that way, and she can pass on that knowledge. I mean, it really
Yes.
is a great way, a phenomenal way to just make waves in our youth, and our youth need something like this right now, especially after a pandemic and all the craziness going on in the world. So I am absolutely so appreciative of what you're doing. I truly believe that
Thank you.
your book needs to be your books need to be everywhere, and more people need to know about it, because if we're just kind of navigating life and we've never experienced these things, you talk about like sexting, right? Some parents have didn't grow up in a generation like that, or grandparents even, and they just don't know. And so
And there
just
are
wanted to.
2.4 million grandparents raising your grandkids who don't have a clue what sexting is.
Right,
I will
right.
tell you that I've accomplished a lot in my life, but the best and most important thing I've ever accomplished is that I broke the generational cycle of abuse in my family.
That's
I
incredible.
broke the cycle. And my kids are safe, and my grandkids are safe and happy. And I mean, that doesn't guarantee they're going to remain safe and happy, but I gave them the best shot I had because I broke the damn cycle.
And being the cycle breaker is hard.
Yes, it
So
is.
you did the
Yeah,
work
I was,
though.
yeah, it's very alienating from one's own family because if you don't, when you start resisting the family dynamics, it becomes uncomfortable for people. They have to change and they don't want to. So,
But that's incredible, and hats off to you. That
thanks.
is
And to
such.
you're doing the same thing.
Thank you. It's a really a amazing feeling knowing that the trajectory of generations is going to be different because you decided to do the work and to break that. And so it gave me chills when you said that, because I'm just like, that's just so cool. And
Yeah, we're
I'm
doing it.
so grateful that I had met you. And really the most unconventional way, I was not expecting when I met you to be connected with such an incredible badass human being, former Marine, that is doing such incredible things. And so I'm so grateful that you came on the show. Where can people, other than Amazon, is there any other place that people can find you and support you and what you are doing?
Yes, I have a website. It's cjscarlett.com, and that's Scarlett with one T, cjscarlett.com. And my email, and I'm very accessible, I'll respond to every email, is cj@cjscarlett.com, cjscarlett.com.
Perfect. And then Amazon, yeah, I assume there's a link on your website to your books as well.
Yes, there sure is.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, I'll make sure to link everything in the show notes. If you are a parent, even if you're not a parent, learn these things because they're valuable, and you never know when someone else might need them. Go ahead
Aunts
and
and
pick
uncles
up.
are big influencers.
Yes, absolutely. If you're listening to this episode, please go pick up a copy of CJ's book, and let me know through the Instagram page _ YSDEH. Let me know if you did grab a copy, how it impacted you, what your feedback is. Feedback is always phenomenal, especially for authors and creators. And so I'll pass on any feedback that I get to you, CJ.
Oh,
But I'm
thank you.
sure people are going to get so much value from your book. I'm so excited to read it myself. The last thing I'm going to ask you is if there's any last words or pieces of advice that you want to leave the listeners with today.
Wow, that's a great question. For the parents, I would say be the parent your child deserves. For those of you who are not parents, but you are influencers in children's lives, that can be grandparents, aunts, uncles, just friends, mentors, whatever. Do your best to support the parents because it is a hard damn job. It is a hard job. And I mean, you know this, Rachel. You love your kid with all your heart, but it is not an easy job. And we don't know what we're doing. We're faking it till we make it. We're doing the best we can and with limited resources and based on our history. And so we often make mistakes. Every parent makes mistakes. So support the parents out there that you know. Tell them that they're appreciated.
Thank you for taking the time to listen in today. With your support, we are able to increase awareness of the mental health issues affecting service members and veterans today with the goal of creating positive change. If you got value from this episode, please take 30 seconds to subscribe and share this episode within your own network. Until next time, remember, your story matters, your mental health matters, and your story doesn't end here.